Leadership, it's more than just a title. It's a journey shaped by decisions, fueled by experiences, and defined by stories. And some of the most powerful stories are the ones you haven't heard just yet. The stories are real, insights game-changing, and the leaders, they're right here. I'm excited. Welcome to Leadership Unscripted. Today, I'm excited to host Paroma Chatterjee, CEO of Revolut India. She's been leading the company for the last 4 years, and continuously last 4 years, she's been in the top 100 most influential women in fintech. It's my pleasure to host her today. Today's conversation is not only going to be unscripted, but it's going to be full of new, innovative, wacky ideas, and I'm trying to do my best to get into Paroma's mind. I've known her for a while, and she has this amazing energy that fills the room with a very different way of thinking. Paroma, firstly, thank you very much for joining us today at Leadership Unscripted. Thank you for taking your time.
Thank you so much for having me here, Prateek. It's amazing to be here and looking forward to the conversation, though you've set the benchmark right off the bat.
Firstly, big, big congratulations. 4 years in a row, top 100 women in the FinTech magazine is no mean feat. And you've been doing it consistently, so big congratulations.
Thank you, Prateek. It's quite humbling to be counted among the top leaders who are shaping fintech, but I will draw more satisfaction from being featured in top 100 leaders overall beyond top 100 women
very
leaders.
Very soon. That's exactly where you are headed.
Thank you.
Paroma, you know, Revolut India and being a CEO of such a fantastic fintech that has made waves globally and leading that entire franchise in India. Just tell us, you know, what's the overall thought process about how Revolut is looking at India in, you know, from a the way they are wanting to leverage the Indian platform?
For how Revolut is looking at India, I will have to take you back 4 years, rewind, back to 2021. At that time, Revolut was all of 6 years old, a six-year-old baby, but a very exciting new kid on the block in the world of financial services. It was present at that time across 22 countries, largely across UK and Europe. And they had got their latest Series E funding, where SoftBank and Tiger Global came in with $350 million and $450 million, respectively. And the orientation with which that funding came in that particular round was to take Revolut beyond the shores of UK and Europe to the big frontiers, the big frontiers of Asia Pacific, specifically South Asia and India, which is acknowledged globally as one of the biggest frontiers of financial services, and the other Latin America with Brazil, Mexico. That was one orientation, and the second orientation was product suite expansion beyond just the core products that Revolut was doing. So in that, against that backdrop, they started looking to enter into India, and that's when I had some fabulous conversations with the founders and decided to jump onto this bandwagon and take on the challenge of starting from laying the foundation to building what Revolut is today and what Revolut will be tomorrow in India. In terms of the specific thought process around that, I think India is looked upon by most global companies and financial services companies as a place where a lot of innovation has happened in the last decade or so. But if anybody can take a slice of the pie, that becomes a significant contributor to that company's customer base. So Revolut has a stated objective of getting to 100 million customers by 2030. And it looks at India being able to contribute at least a quarter of that. So that's sort of the perspective from a customer acquisition point of view. And a Revolut ethos, which has been there in every single country that Revolut has launched, is to eventually be able to bring all of Revolut's products along with their innovative edge into every market that we launch. So even in India, the orientation is to eventually bring the products that Revolut is known and acclaimed for globally, all the product suite for consumers in India over time. Those were the two from a business and product lens. And while we started building for those products in India, we realized the kind of talent that is available in India, which is high-end talent on product consulting, strategy, tech, all of that. And Revolut then decided to make this the first hub outside of its original London hub to bring on the talent that is available in India to actually start building for the rest of the markets Revolut is present in. So that's sort of the three-pronged orientation. And one underlying philosophy that continues to remain for Revolut even here is we could have decided, like a lot of the fintechs, in the interest of speed and a quick go-to-market, to partner with the banks and other financial institutions and distribute their product on our platform and gain market entry, but decided to go the more painful, if you will, but longer and steadier path to actually get our own licenses, to be able to build our own products, be able to control the customer experience the way we want to differentiate and be able to bring that differentiated offering out.
Which means a lot in terms of committed to India, wanting to be here from a longer term standpoint.
Oh yes, so from that standpoint, a couple of other things that Revolut has done, which is one, the upfront investment in technology and localization. So as you would know, being in financial services, one of the things that global companies are required to do is localize their entire data stack for India so that no data goes overseas, no customer data, no personally PII information, no transaction information. Yeah. And we all know on certain actions that have happened on certain global companies for certain components that hadn't been adequately localized.
It's a long, painstaking process. Absolutely.
So for a lot of companies, it's taken, a lot of global companies, global financial services companies, it's taken them years and a lot of investment to localize the tech stack over time.
Yeah.
And that's an upfront investment that Revolut has made.
That speaks volumes of the commitment.
Absolutely. And that has resulted in gaining enormous credibility, touchwood, with the ecosystem over here. That a company who comes in wanting to take licenses, puts the entire compliance framework first, proactively seeks to get regulated, and localizes its tech stack upfront, invests in a high quality team of people with financial services background who come in to build all of this. So I think the foundation that is being laid is extremely strong.
You've worked at ICICI, Kotak, Airtel, Money, and Flipkart. So range of organizations. Leader as you are, how are all your past experiences and learnings from there make you the leader that you are today?
One of the first learnings from our home environment, and I come from a middle-class Bengali family, where one of the ethics that was taught to us and became core and second nature was the value of education and knowledge and learning over chasing more material outcomes of a flash value or a tag or monetary success. The second, beyond family, the kind of education institutions that I've been fortunate to have been a part of and gone to, that has inculcated a liberal, open-minded attitude in me, which I continue to hold on to. The entire thing about being open to new learnings, being able to adapt, taking on learnings from anywhere in the world, any section of society, any other company, any other industry, bringing that on and building it into your ethos and your products and your strategy. I think that openness, and with the other hand, being open enough to share what you do. So the learnings that you have inculcated from whatever business you're learning or your experiences, be open to sharing that with the larger world, because then others benefit and you overall grow as an industry.
Which is very true for financial services of today, if you want to be relevant, is to really be open rather than just thinking about what A bank did vis-a-vis B bank, because today you are really learning from a very wide set of peers, not necessarily financial services.
Correct. The first company that I worked for, which you named ICICI Bank, I was associated with launching the first co-branded cards in India.
Wow.
Now, you think about it, the problem, when I joined at that time, I suddenly feel old when I speak about it as when I joined more than two decades ago now. But at that time, the entire bank had all of 10,000 card customers. This was the era when our parents got a diner's card after they had become successful in life when they were in their 50s. That was the backdrop against which an ICICI bank decides, let's go get 100,000 cards.
Yeah.
And they give a brief to a 22-year-old young management trainees, and not just me, there was a group of management trainees who were joined together, to go after this kind of an agenda. It may sound out of the world, but yes, that made us think differently.
What an opportunity.
Exactly. That's what I was coming to, this openness of learning.
Yeah.
So I could have looked at it as purely data. You know, sit on a computer, go through data, look at Excel and go and say, okay, this particular category of payments is what we should create a product around and build something on that. Instead, I actually went around and just hung around on Linking Road. In Mumbai, if you know what I'm talking about, you're anyway from Mumbai. And what I spent time was observing how people are shopping.
Yeah.
So I think, the second thing that has continued through my institutions that I've been associated with, whether from an education point of view or from a work point of view, have encouraged me to be very open about trying innovation.
Yes, I see a lot of EQ and empathy in the way, you know, you sort of crafted it.
I actually think to be a good leader, EQ is as important as IQ.
Of course.
And it's fairly underrated. We have a lot of us over-index in our early years of our career on IQ, thinking that's what's going to get us to grow.
Yeah.
It does get us to grow in the early years of the career when your IQ gets tested on your competence. But EQ, it needs to be developed over time.
Especially especially in this part of the world.
Yeah, I remember one of my IIM professors who used to teach us organizational behavior. He went on to become the dean of one of the other IIM subsequently. That's one of the classes a lot of people would not turn up for because they thought, you know, corporate valuation and quantitative ability in management, those kind of courses are the important
ones we need to work for. Yeah.
And these ones, we can sleep through those classes and get a grade. But he had said something in class which stayed with me, saying, today you may not realize it, but 20 years later, if God willing, you get a chance to be at the top of a company, you'll realize this is probably the single most important course that will be relevant at that point of time.
So true.
And it so resonates
today. So true. FinTech in India has gone through its own evolution from the hype to funding winters to competition with financial services, the larger banks, to collaboration. As a leader, now where do you see, you know, the FinTech place evolving? And if I fast forward next 4-5 years, just broad sense where the financial services market is going to evolve and how the FinTech vis-a-vis the traditional banks will play out. It's your thoughts.
I think it's going to evolve into two segments of FinTech and TechFin. Today it's a conglomerate. I think we have some 10,732 FinTechs on record as of when I had seen the data last. But it's an aggregation of different people who look at different parts of the pie. Somebody could be a proper regulated licensed fintech. What that means is offering a certain product which is regulated and licensed in a tech first manner. Two, somebody else could be a technology provider who's an enabler to the rest of the financial services.
Right.
And I think that is that difference is going to become sharper.
Okay.
And there is going to be a set of fintechs who offer financial services in a technology first manner and a set of tech fins who actually provide the tech backbone to other companies
other
who provide
services
financial services.
Absolutely.
That's one thing that I certainly see happening.
Sure.
The second thing, I think we still have some way to go. Maybe a decade, I don't know, maybe 5 years. But I do see a full-fledged digital bank become a reality over time. Today, it's not in India. It is there in certain parts of the globe. But what do I mean by a true digital bank? Today, fintechs have different licenses and somebody offers a domestic payment wallet.
Yeah.
Somebody offers a digital lending service. Somebody offers a digital wealth management service, etc. But somebody who offers end-to-end retail banking services without the need of a physical bank branch, yeah, or the need to withdraw cash or the need to write checks or take demand drafts out. I think if you look at the data of consumer behavior on how much cash is being withdrawn vis-a-vis how many checks are being written to how many drafts are being issued, I think consumer behavior is orienting towards being digital only.
Absolutely.
And particularly with the demographics changing of the sub 25-year-old right now, and that is the segment that's going to keep growing.
Yeah.
The people who are coming into the banking or bankable segment, who are going to become 18+
absolutely,
right now, are all digital natives.
Yeah.
They're digital first. They think of anything digital first.
Yeah.
They order something on the app before going down to a corner store. Whereas our generation went through that transition,
yeah,
of going down to the corner store to pick up the eggs and bread, to making it a habit to download the app,
yeah,
to flagging down a taxi on the road, to hailing it on the app.
Absolutely.
But this new generation that's coming up, they are digital first. Yeah.
They
haven't
seen
digital
the other
natives.
Side. Absolutely.
And I don't think they see the need to do it because they're looking for the most convenient way to do it and the most secure way to do it.
Yeah.
As long as the industry is able to deliver on convenience and affordability along with the security, I think that's the way in which it's going to go. And consumer is always the trendsetter, and they're always the king.
Yeah.
What they want is what we will be doing as an industry.
Yeah.
So I think that will become another reality. The other thing that I see emerging is a lot more cross-border alignment and engagements. Mm. Because even in India, today, we have touched 25 lakh crore of UPI transactions.
Yeah.
It sounds mind-boggling, but it's all within India on domestic payments,
yeah,
right? There is this whole global ecosystem of money moving out and money coming in.
Which is waiting to be disrupted.
Absolutely, and that's where we're working.
I know.
So, but that is the next area, which
clearly,
I think is going to get disrupted, because I know there are cross-border regulatory conversations,
right,
and panels also now, where they're trying to align on some kind of a common standard.
Yeah.
Like passport was arrived at as a common universal travel standard, which multiple countries will adopt with their own visa requirements on top of it.
Of course.
So something of that analogy will be something that will become a reality, which will go towards making the global Indian today an actual global financial citizen,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
So that if you have to open an account in India and transact in the UK, you can do it seamlessly and both the regulators know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah,
and you can do it in a safe and secure manner. So that's the third thing that I see happening.
Mm.
And in relation to that, I think a lot more work is going to happen on the reg tech and fraud tech. Because as technology has leapfrogged, a lot of people have tried to hack the system, and we're all aware of the kind of frauds that have happened. A lot of it is also to do with a lack of understanding and education as well. When something really grows like this phenomenally, not everybody of the 500 million Indians who are using it with full knowledge of where things can get compromised. So a lot of work will happen on closer transaction monitoring, anti-money laundering, closer fraud controls, sanctions, checks, universal blacklists. And I think a lot of tech is going, and machine learning is going to drive that. So that's the fourth area. The fifth, I actually see AI and Gen AI taking over at least 70% of the things that are being done right now, the way it is shaping up.
Yeah.
And that has to be done really responsibly by the industry. But I see AI doing a lot of decisioning, whether it's credit underwriting decisions or even fraud advanced triggers, lead triggers, etc. So that's the fifth trend I see. And sixth, I actually see somewhere financial services going back to the basics as well. Because if you think about it, while we're all celebrating the success of UPI, there are 400 million Indians who have still not tried digital payments, right? And there are reasons to that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the innovation has been smartphone first.
Mm.
But to think of taking it to the world beyond smartphones, on feature phones, on devices like wearables, So one aspect is that there are a lot of sections of society, whether it's the senior citizens or it is the differently abled. I think actual consciousness about building for them is the sixth thing that I think that's going to come in.
Yeah, and I think the government is also building a lot of the ancillary surround sound, not only UPI, but now with the AgriStack sort of getting done, the land records getting digitized.
Yes.
I think a lot of that will feed in seamlessly with, you know, what, you know, the world is sort of moving towards.
Absolutely.
And that's where I believe, you know, a lot of these pieces for the underbanked will change dramatically because,
yes,
you know, these pieces will become a big aid.
So if I can risk my neck out and predict, like, I don't know, 10 years later, 5 years later, I don't think we'll be referring to it as digital payments anymore.
Yeah.
It'll be payments.
Payments. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think this part will, I'm sure a lot of viewers will view it because, again, I'm in the same camp. I do believe with Gen Z, and we just did a recent survey for Gen Z across cities, across suburbans, urban city, and so on. The way they have caught up to using digital and being digital first is not funny. And I don't imagine for a branch of a future, unless there is a differentiated experience, why would a customer walk in? But I think, Paroma, what you just said, I think a lot of financial services or the high street banks are also now wanting to learn from, you know, how organizations like Revolut are thinking and reorganizing themselves, unlike the traditional approach, while saying, obviously there is a way to go, but product teams, having, you know, not having this whole breakup between business, digital, technology as siloed function, but really bringing groups of people working together as a pod, solving problems. So I think obviously in a different environment and it needs a different culture to build. But if we don't solve for it, I think the cap tables might turn very significantly if we don't prepare for what's about to come. So what are you taking from India to Revolut, the made in India factor?
The very fact that Revolut's first outside London hub is here, where we're employing close to 50% of Revolut's global population, and we're not just building for India, our employees over here are working on building for the rest of the Asia Pacific markets and the world, and almost the entire transaction banking, the banking backend of our European operations is today run from here, whether it is your onboarding of customers all the way to fraud investigations. So I think that very fact that we're proving that we can make in India for the world, I think is a case study that I'm very, very proud of. And the fact that a global company of the chops of Revolut, which is the second highest valued fintech globally, acknowledges that and is investing further in that is testament to that.
And I can tell you 50% of the global headcount for any large financial services companies to be based out of India, you will be number one. I don't think
there are two aspects to it, actually.
Yeah.
More than just the sheer headcount, the part that I'm proud of
is the value.
Is that it is the high-end jobs.
Yes.
These are the jobs that people across different countries, youngsters, would aspire to have.
Absolutely.
Right? That's the kind of jobs.
Yeah.
It's not just the back end. It's not the old world outsourcing as it was thought of.
Of course.
And that's something that I'm really, really proud of having built and being able to showcase on a world stage.
Mm.
The second is, even from the product that we're building, India's technology, UPI, you wouldn't believe it. When we had our co-founder come here and actually have a Nariyal Pani on the road and pay using the UPI and see that sound box actually talking about it, it opens the world's eyes to it. So they have also become advocates of taking UPI international, because I think UPI is an amazing track that we have built.
Yes.
The entire Trinity that we've built.
Of course.
So that is another thing, the fact that there is global recognition of that, and part of the submissions and the conversations that happen over there as part of the G20 submissions, and particularly the UK-India corridor conversations, where these are being showcased, I think is the second matter of pride, to see a homegrown technology being taken up globally by your own company and then the rest of the world.
Absolutely.
The third aspect is also the entire Aadhaar. So Revolut's authentication historically has been on the way the rest of the world has done it, which has been passport selfie based.
Mm.
The fact that we have a biometric identity for a billion plus people, which can be used to authenticate in a stronger fashion, that's another eye opener that that we can export.
Yeah.
To go and say it's doable.
Yeah.
It's doable at a billion scale.
Yeah.
To have everybody have a biometric identity, and that's a tighter authentication than anything else that can be anywhere else.
Yeah.
And last but not the least, the cultural nuance. So I think some of the things in working for a global team, I've realized that there is a marked difference in style of working in the Western world and here in India.
Mm.
One of the basic things that relationship matters. You spoke about the fact that EQ matters.
Yeah.
When you're stuck on a problem, it's not just about looking at a screen and trying to solve it. It's about walking across the corridor or setting up an online conversation with somebody and sorting things out through conversations. That's another cultural thing that I'm happy to gradually bring into the Revolut culture, that talk and solve problems.
Yeah.
The only advice, a few words of advice that I can maybe share from my own life and experiences is, again, taking on from the two things we touched upon. One is to not get emotional and attached to your job. A lot of us, I did so in the early years of my career as well, attached a lot of importance and my identity to what I do, the kind of job that I have, the place that I work for.
We take it very personally.
We take it very, very personally. And then things like quarterly ratings and assessments and promotions vis-a-vis a peer set that we benchmark ourselves against, the compensation that we are earning, again, usually compared to a set that we benchmark ourselves against, we take some of these things way too seriously. And the biggest word of advice that I can share with the youngsters after more than two decades of experience and coming here is not to take any of them seriously.
Yeah, so true.
Right? You need to work for the sheer joy of working. So I have always chosen my assignments based on what excited me the most.
Yeah. Where you get joy.
Where I get joy from doing it, where I could see that I could do something with it or something creative or innovative with it and make a difference.
Yeah.
The second thing I would encourage people to have is a meaningful life outside of even the professional work that they do. A lot of times the work becomes all-consuming. Yes, we spend bulk of our hours during the weekdays on work. Even during weekends, we end up thinking about it because we're so passionately involved in it. But having something, whether it is writing or reading or playing a sport or playing a musical instrument or traveling, I think it is important to have something else in life going on. And that's the balance
that's
that is needed.
That's the balance. What rejuvenates you?
A few things, actually. One, I'm an avid reader. Second, actually, this has become more prominent now, spending time with my child. Because in this kind of a career, you have to balance out time between the child that you love in the workplace and the child that you love at home.
Yeah.
And the third is playing a sport. That's my idea of fitness. I don't go to a gym, but I play. Or the fourth thing is painting. I've always had an affinity.
You have to have something. I was gonna go down that path. Being a Bengali, there has to be some artistic, either a poetry or a painting.
So to me, when the minutes that I spend in front of my canvas are my go-to, my escape, if you will, my meditation, my way of
your therapy,
my way of getting away from the uncertainties of life for those few minutes.
Given you have a visitor from Bombay coming to meet you in Bangalore, I'm going to bring a bit of Bollywood to do what we call as the flash finesse. It's our rapid fire. In a playful manner to ask you some volley of questions. Tell me whatever first comes to your mind. So if you weren't in finance, what career you would be in?
I think going by what we spoke about, I'd probably be an artist.
Painter?
Yes. So today I travel the world. My job takes me all around the world, right? I might have been going around the world displaying my work in galleries.
Fantastic. Yeah. One word that describes your leadership style.
I can't pick one. Can I pick three? Because I switch between leadership styles based on situation. I think one of the things that stands out is coaching. Whenever I have raw talent who's yet to be untapped, and I push my people to excel. The second is authoritative, because when you have to set a vision and get an entire organization aligned behind it, you need to be authoritative. And the third is pace setting, because I believe in daily excellence. Every single day, then you need to be pace setting. So I alternate between probably largely these three leadership styles, depending on the circumstance.
Interesting. One advice you will give to younger Paroma, your younger self?
Younger...
If any.
Younger Paroma. don't be in a hurry. Life is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
So true, so true. A myth about women in leadership that you would like to bust?
The fact that we like being called women in leadership. We don't like being called women in leadership. We are leaders.
Leaders.
We're leaders who are as competent, if not more than our male counterparts. And that's how we would love to be thought of. By giving us women awards, I don't think we appreciate it.
Are you into luxury or sustainable fashion? Or both?
Look at me. What do you think?
Street food or fine dining?
Sustainable fashion.
I know. It speaks for itself. Street food or fine dining?
Street food. I come from Kolkata. I still love the puchka and the jhalmuri that is available the street side of Kolkata whenever I get to go there.
Oh, lovely.
You come from Mumbai. Even Mumbai street food stands out.
But nothing beats Kolkata. Ask me.
You.
Trust me. I'm a big fan as well. So you are an early bird or a night owl?
I'm a night owl.
Any leader that you wish you want to, you know, have a podcast with or follow or have a coffee with, or spend a day with, it could be anyone, not necessarily in financial services, anyone you admire.
I'd want to do one with Mithali Raj. I'll tell you why.
Right.
Because cricket is religion in India, and it was completely male-dominated.
Yeah.
She is the first woman captain who brought women's cricket onto the map
mainstream,
to the WPL that is today.
Yeah.
I want to be able to sit across the board with the cue cards in my hand and have that conversation with her to look inside her head and what did she go through and what her experiences were in an arena like that, which every Indian looks at to bring women's cricket on the map. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Mithali Raj will get this video and I'm sure that is going to happen.
Okay, Mithali, that's our next podcast.
Okay, so this is lovely. Thank you so much for your time. As we wind up, given you have multiple interests, poetry, song, anything that, summarizes or you believe is a good sort of summary of who Paroma is. It could be a movie, it could be a song, it could be your go-to moment when chips are down or when you are happy, anything.
What summarizes me?
Yeah.
Robert Farr Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken.
Mm. Mm.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler, long I stood, and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, and just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, for it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference.
Fantastic. Paroma, it's been lovely to meet you. Thank you so much for spending time with us. I'm certain you will inspire a lot of young leaders, new leaders, who will want to travel the road less traveled. Thank you so much for spending.
I hope that does happen. And it has been an absolutely enjoyable conversation. Pratik, thanks for having me here.
Thank you.